standing business before this honorable court are none drawnier and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. First case of the morning will be Singh versus John Ashcroft. Mr. Kim.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the court? My name is Sean Kim on behalf of the appellant, Nirmar Singh. So this is a political asylum case, and the appellant raised four issues on his appeal. I think I can narrow it down to two main issues. The first issue is whether the immigration judge erred in misapplying or misinterpreting the law in determining whether one qualifies for an asylum. And the answer to that issue is yes. The second issue is, was the immigration judge's decision denying the applicant's claim for asylum supported by substantial evidence? And the answer to that issue is no. Now, the Immigration and Naturalization Code, although it states what one must prove to be eligible for asylum, and that is either a past persecution or a well-founded fear of future persecution, it doesn't clearly state what standards or tests to apply as far as the evidence and proof are concerned. However, the case law is clear in that one's testimony alone may be sufficient to be eligible for asylum, and then nothing more if the testimony is detailed, specific, and credible. In this case, the appellant's testimony was specific, detailed, and credible.
Well, isn't credibility a question, though, for the immigration judge to assess? For example, I mean, simply being Sikh isn't enough to show under current circumstances that one is going to be persecuted. Some Sikhs are and some Sikhs are not. And the immigration judge came to the conclusion that Mr. Singh simply wasn't one of them facing a risk of persecution.
Yes, Your Honor. The immigration judge based his ruling of adverse credibility determination on two facts alone. And those are that the appellant was not wearing a turban and the appellant did not have a beard, which are common characteristics of a Sikh individual. However, they're not the only characteristics, nor are they a mandatory characteristic, especially in light of the fact that the appellant explained why he didn't have those two characteristics.
But that explanation itself was subject to evaluation by the immigration judge. He certainly did offer an explanation, but it's not until 1996 that he takes this step of shaving the beard and stopping wearing the turban.
That is correct. There was testimony that he did have a turban on prior to that date, as well as the beard, but because of the numerous arrests and torture by the Indian authorities and the injuries he received as a result of those arrests and tortures, that his physician advised him not to wear a turban.
But you see, that was one of the things that I found difficult to evaluate, I'll put it that way, because ordinary lay people, such as at least myself, wouldn't know whether those kinds of symptoms could occur from after beatings, from having a beard or wearing a turban, whether they couldn't. There's no medical evidence in this record to suggest that this is something that a doctor would want, much less medical evidence that his doctor thought this was a reasonable measure.
Even if this court believes that those two grounds alone are sufficient to make the adverse credibility determination, the appellant also testified other aspects or facets of a Sikh religion. He went in great detail about the various tenets of the Sikh religion.
He had great knowledge. The immigration judge believed he was Sikh, I think. I think his question was he one of those who's being persecuted?
Yes, and as far as the persecution and the torture are concerned, the appellant also went in great detail about the events of arrest, how, when, where he was tortured, and more importantly, he sustained injuries as a result of those arrests, and he showed in open court his injuries.
But how does the judge know those injuries are from those events? Is there anything to link them up other than his word for it?
No. One of the issues, many issues, was that the appellant did not have medical records to substantiate those injuries. But nevertheless, there was testimony, specific and detailed testimony, as to how he was tortured, how he sustained those injuries. And I think the case law also states that even if the immigration judge makes an adverse credibility determination, that alone is not fatal to one's asylum claim. If the appellant can come forward with a corroborating evidence, in this case, I think the appellant did so by providing a specific and detailed testimony along with the physical injury, photos of the injuries, as well as showing the judge in open court his injuries.
How was the time period between the alleged persecution and those injuries and the time that he cut his hair and his beard?
I believe the injuries occurred sometime in 1986.
And he cut his hair and beard in 96, right?
I'm not sure exactly when.
Well,
his beard.
Approximately 10 years later.
That is correct.
Which the judge, I believe, took into consideration, say that seems not very coincidental with the supposedly injuries that required this haircut and shave.
Well, this was an ongoing event, and I believe the testimony was that after many visits to his physician, he was complaining of headaches, psychological and mental problems as well as physical problems. And it was towards the end of that stretch of time that he was advised to take off his turban and cut his beard. But I'll take this even a step further. Even if this court believes that the appellant didn't come forward with sufficient corroborating evidence, that too is not fatal to one's asylum claim, if the appellant can explain to the court one of two things.
But could I just say, I mean, you're saying it's not fatal to the claim, and if this were the initial hearing, I could imagine making that argument. But you have to convince us that there's no way the judge could have come to the result he came to, which is looking at it, I think, from the other end of the telescope. And why isn't the evidence in this record enough to at least permit the inference, if not compel it, that the judge came to?
Well, that's why there are three steps to the analysis of asylum and the sufficiency of the evidence. First, the testimony alone, and if the judge finds the testimony to be incredible, then the appellant can overcome that burden by submitting corroborating evidence. And if the judge determines that corroborating evidence is also insufficient, we can also overcome that by explaining to the judge whether the corroborating evidence was not easily or readily available for him to obtain, or even if it is easily or readily obtainable, why the appellant himself was not able to obtain them. And we have done that in this case.
If you want to save any rebuttal time, you might
consider
that.
Okay, thanks. Ms. McKay?
Good morning, Your Honors. Leslie McKay for the respondent, John Ashcroft. Your Honors, this is not a credibility case. This is a case about weight and sufficiency of the evidence in the record.
But Ms. McKay, let me point out something to you that gives me great concern about the way the immigration judge handled this case. It's either a gross misstatement of the fact or a failure to take into account some of the evidence. In his order, and I'm looking specifically at the bottom of page 5 and the top of page 6, he says, The respondent continued to live in India without being arrested by the police from 1993 to 1996. Well, what he makes no acknowledgement of in that sentence is the testimony, as far as I know, unrebutted, that he was in hiding during that period of time. This court has cases that say, well, if the only way you can live safely in a country is to go underground and to be in hiding, that's not really anything that makes one have confidence that it's safe for you to live there. The immigration judge seems oblivious to this fact, and without taking it into account, giving us some reason to think that, notwithstanding the fact that he was in hiding, somehow there's no fear of persecution, it really doesn't inspire much confidence in the opinion.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it is entirely clear on this record that he was in hiding during the time that he was in New Delhi.
He testified that he was. There are a number of citations to the record, and what do you have to suggest that he wasn't?
Well, he also testified that he rented an office, that he was in charge of a film production company, that he was vitally involved in the production of a film for Amnesty International. In that context, it's difficult to believe if you want to believe him that he was so vital to the production of this film that he was running a production company, that he was also in hiding at that time.
He wasn't practicing law. He stopped practicing law, right?
Correct.
Do we know if he was using a pseudonym?
I do not believe that that is in the record. I do not know.
Anyway, you're speculating right now on the spot. I don't blame you for doing that, because what else can you do? The fact is, it's not in the immigration judge's opinion. We don't know whether the immigration judge considered other evidence that suggested maybe he wasn't in hiding, whether the immigration judge didn't even pay any attention during that period of time during the testimony. It's a big gap in the record, and it looks from this sentence as though the immigration judge thinks things are just fine from 1993 to 1996.
Well, Your Honor, even if that's the case, even if there is a weakness in this IJ decision, which I certainly would agree with you that there might be, I don't think that that's fatal to this claim if you're still looking to the objective reasonableness of petitioner's claimed fear of future persecution, taking out his ability to relocate to New Delhi and live there for 3 years, where, in hiding or not, nothing happened.
All right, assume though in hiding.
Okay.
Suppose you moved to some city and you had to live in some basement and never show your face during the daytime and sneak off to the Amnesty International offices to work on a film. That might not make you feel safe.
Okay. Assuming that, we still have evidence that it's been nearly 2 decades since the major instance of past harm that he alleges, in 1986. We still have evidence that he left India on his own passport through normal exit procedures. He paid an exit fee. We still have evidence on the record by his own testimony that he recently renewed his Indian passport at the consulate here in Chicago. Those factors make it reasonable for the immigration judge to conclude, even assuming that he was in hiding during those 3 years in New Delhi, that at this point his fear of future persecution is not reasonable.
Does the United States government have a policy of opposing asylum requests from people who are coming from countries with which we have friendly relations, like India?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, and I mean that would be a question better posed to the State Department, possibly.
Well, I mean, to put this case in context, is there any way we could find out how many Sikhs have applied for asylum and been granted asylum from India in the last several years or something? Are those statistics available?
I believe those statistics are maintained, Your Honor, by the Executive Office for Immigration Review, and possibly available on the Internet, but I couldn't swear to that.
I mean, do you have, I know the record here doesn't tell us this, but put this case into some kind of context with other cases?
I'm sorry, I don't have any information.
I mean, India is a democracy with which a country that we have very good relations.
Right.
And
I understand that, and certainly there are political consequences in the immigration context, and that, again, is why the Supreme Court has created the substantial evidence standard of review, to leave those political questions to the political side of the government.
You don't mean to say that because of politics we would refuse to grant asylum to somebody who was being tortured just because
Absolutely
we were...
Absolutely not.
That can't be...
Absolutely not.
And by the same token, that we would not grant asylum to somebody who faces a well-founded fear of future persecution in a country.
Absolutely not. No.
Because I could imagine a similar situation, perhaps in times past, I'll be optimistic and say in times past, when somebody in Northern Ireland might have wanted political asylum here because of persecution by the British authorities. And I can hardly think of a country with which we have friendlier relations and in which we have more confidence in the government as a whole. But could there, if there were on the facts a particular case, you can't mean that we wouldn't, that we would just say, well, you're from the UK, never mind.
No, absolutely not. And all I'm meaning to say is that exactly, the court's review is limited to the record before it. And if the record before you now compels the conclusion that the immigration judge was wrong in this case, then a grant would be appropriate.
What if it compelled the conclusion that he just needed to take another look at it and consider all of the evidence?
Then I would suggest remanding to the agency. I certainly wouldn't agree that on this record the record would compel that conclusion, but if that's the court's decision, then I would suggest a remand.
When you talked about, when the IJ talked about the moving to New Delhi,
mm-hmm.
From where?
He moved from Uttar Pradesh, I believe, which is approximately 100 miles from New Delhi.
Could it be looked at that his moving to New Delhi actually means he is hiding? It doesn't necessarily mean he's in a basement, but could it mean that he's in another location where they don't know where he is?
Well, it's actually not clear from the record. In his testimony, he states that he had to stop practicing law and move away from Uttar Pradesh due to constant police harassment. However, in his asylum interview and asylum application, he stated that he moved because some Hindu people were creating problems for his career. So it's not clear at all really what caused him to move to New Delhi or what his situation was once he got there.
Well, in New Delhi, he was working on this film and some other things. Is there any indication he had to do this really undercover and under some sort of shroud that in order not to anyone to see him, or was this just because he's in New Delhi? Nobody happens to be looking for him in that location.
He testified generally that he was in hiding. He stated that he was staying at a friend's house. There's no other real evidence of what steps or procedures he was taking to keep himself undercover, to keep himself from being identified by the police at any point. He was not practicing law, but again, he was in charge of this film production office and producing a film for Amnesty International. Unless the court has further questions, we would respectfully request, based on this record, that substantial evidence supports the IJ's conclusion and that does not compel a contrary conclusion, and request that the petition be denied.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Kim, do you have anything to add?
In order to prove well-founded future persecution, one has to prove that he has subjectively genuine fear of persecution, as well as objectively reasonable fear of future persecution. I don't think neither the immigration judge nor the INS raised or challenged the subjectiveness of this test. With respect to the objectiveness of this test, as Your Honor has indicated, that the appellant was an attorney practicing law in his hometown. When he moved to New Delhi, he stopped practicing law, and his main focus was helping the organization create this documentary movie.
So what's your response to government counsel's point that that doesn't sound very hidden if he's out there producing a movie for Amnesty International?
Well, I think the operative word is out there, or phrase. He was not out there. He was in the AISSF, All Indian Sikh Student Federation compound, although for some time, I'm not exactly sure how long, he was with his friend. I don't think there was any testimony or evidence that he was out there in the open public for the authorities or the police to easily find him.
And so you would say there's testimony in the record that he remained in this compound?
I believe so. And one more thing, if I can add, is that several years ago, appellant's mother passed away. And I think any objective person would have gone back to India to attend the funeral if he did not fear the authorities. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.